They say the world is spinning around. I say the world is upside down. They say the world is spinning around. I say the world is upside down.
Signal.
This is Miguel Gavilan Molina, and today we are Radio Free Alcatraz. I'm joined here with AIM West director, Don Gonzalez. We're back here. It looks like we first came out here back in 1990-91.
Oh, yes,
and this is the 27th, 28th year we've been bringing Radio Free Alcatraz. And thank you for starting that tradition. And here we are.
Oh, yes, indeed. We're back, and indeed to carry on the legacy that John Trudell had begun here during the occupation that began November 1969 until June of 71. 1971, 19 months. That was inspirational. It sent a message around the world that Indian people are still here, struggling for their rights, and moved on to, I would say, a historical culmination, Miguel, when the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Declaration on the Rights of the World's Indigenous Peoples. And that was, you know, from the inspiration that emanated from the young men and women, you know, that took the island, you know, back in the day. And today we are celebrating. You can hear the sound of the drum coming up the hill here at Alcatraz, the Rock, commemorating 526 years of indigenous people's
resistance
to colonization throughout the Western Hemisphere. And now Indian people, 400 million strong around the world, and every day that number is increasing, because it is, we are all the Indians now. Now we know that we are the indigenous peoples, all of us, the four sacred colors that we declare, proclaim, the red, the white, and the yellow, and the black. And that also marks the four directions beginning
right,
here.
The four directions, four colors, the four winds. And we've seen recently, Don, a few weeks back with the whole climate change conference conventions here in the Bay Area, San Francisco. People from all over the world, all over the Americas, came, and what was really powerful was seeing that it was indigenous peoples. It was AIM leading those marches, leading those rallies.
Well, and Miguel, and as Fred Short, our spiritual advisor for American Indian Movement here in the Greater Bay Area, had said, that it's the only right thing to do is to carry the staffs, you know, and the inspiration of those that led the struggle, you know, early on. Indeed, this year marks 50 years of the birth of the American Indian Movement, Miguel, in July 1968. In Minneapolis, in Minnesota, you know, when men and women
got together
and began to chart out a course. But indeed, as we're talking today, you know, Christopher Colon is still wanted and being sought throughout the hemisphere, you know. So if anybody sees him, you know, go after him, you know. But it also tells us, Miguel, that the struggle, you know, continues.
500 years after the invasion. It wasn't a conquest. It was an invasion. And to date, we resisted. And what did Colon, what did Christopher Columbus bring to the indigenous, bring to this land, Anahuac, this land, Las Americas? He brought grand theft, genocide, racism. He initiated the destruction of a culture, rape, torture, and maiming of indigenous peoples, and instigator of the big lie, you know, discovering America. No, he was lost and destitute. But here we are today, seeing the resistance and the reaffirmation of indigenous nations, indigenous tribes within the Americas.
Yes, shattered forever, as we now are declaring throughout the United States, for example. Over 60 cities today, right now, Miguel, have declared Indigenous Peoples Day. And indeed, San Francisco here, the metropolis cosmopolitan, finally adopted by resolution, the second Monday in October will be Indigenous Peoples Day. You know, the time finally came. Of course, Berkeley began when?
1992, yes.
And as I said, the cities across the country every day are moving toward recognizing that and shattering the myths themselves of the past history of a lie that isn't convincing anymore. You know, just as Columbus had proven to the world that it's round, now we are proving to the world that Columbus was a big lie. So, you know, that's what we're here for, is to commemorate, recharge. And all throughout the Americas today, people are commemorating the survival and the resistance to decolonization. We are now decapitalizing as well, as we search for sustainable way of living and surviving the capitalist system that we have now been engulfed by the world, right? Global markets and capitalism. It's a race to the bottom, and that's changing. That's got to change. So along with the decolonization is the decapitalization, Miguel. I think that was really stated in September as you were talking about the climate change conference
that went on.
People from throughout the world, that's what everybody was chanting too, system change.
Right, and decapitalization, or stop the investment in Wall Street banks and the Wall Street giants.
That's right.
Divest.
And by the way, if people want to go to see about divestment and what banks we need to divest from, you can go to the website of mazaskatalks.org. That's mazaskatalks.org. Mazaska Talks. That Mazaska is in the Lakota language, Miguel, meaning money. So moneytalks.org, mazaskatalks.org, because we are into a divestment era. And I think Standing Rock was the catalytic moment
that brought
everybody together back in the last 2 years, you know, in North Dakota. Madonna Thunderhawk, people may know that she has a new film documentary about her life. It's called Warrior Women. And here, Madonna Thunderhawk. Welcome,
hello.
Welcome, and good morning to San Francisco. And Madonna, I had mentioned on the radio that there's a film out, and it's called Warrior Women, where you show women in leadership roles, and such as yourself. You want to tell us a little bit about?
Oh man, it's more than that. You know,
it's
a community. Uh-huh. Community. You know, that's why we made it to use in community work. So it's not your average documentary, you know. Uh-huh. And because of funders, of course, we were rookies, you know, naive to the whole documentary making scene. So people that help you fund this type work, man, that they, you know, they want to control which way you're going, what you're doing, you know. So it's kind of interesting, but it got done, you know. It's all good, you know.
I'm sure that you know, you put a lot into it. I mean, this is probably the first time you've been involved in a movie.
Oh,
in a documentary,
yeah.
and particularly about your life and the role you played in some of the many issues that the movie presents, all the way like before Wounded Knee, through Wounded Knee, South Dakota, 1973, through that period, and fast forward into Standing Rock in North Dakota, and you were there the at least a year and a half there at the camp. Can you tell us about
Well, first of all, I'll tell you, it all started here. We were at, back in the day in 69,
oh, that's right.
Yeah, we were on occupying Mount Rushmore in South Dakota, and I met up with John Trudell, and he said that we need some help organizing.
And Lehman Brightman
community
was at that time as well, right?
Yeah. That's how I ended up out here on the island.
Wow.
But it was a year later. It had already been occupied for about a year. So, so that's where it all started for me.
And you didn't come alone, right? You brought one of your kids.
Youngest daughter, she was 5 years old at the time.
Dawn?
Yes.
And Dawn is here among us in the circle.
Yeah, she's here
on the rock.
In the crowd.
She wasn't in the movie, or Marcella?
No. Your
other daughter?
My oldest daughter, yeah.
She was in this movie, Warrior Women.
Yeah.
That will be screened once again to our listeners tonight at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. And the doors will be open at 6 o'clock, and the movie begins at 6:30. Madonna Thunderhawk, whom we're talking to right now, will be present tonight, and some maybe Q&A after the movie. And Madonna, I had the privilege of seeing the movie also. There was a limited number last month.
Yeah.
And it was presented by the International Green Film Festival.
Yes.
And that was terrific, and you know, which is why,
yeah, who knew, huh?
Yeah. And by the way, as we're talking about your film Warrior Women, right after or before, I can't remember, but there was Water Warriors, directed by Michael Premo, and it's a 22-minute video, and that too will be screened at the Roxy tonight.
You're listening to Radio Free Alcatraz. We're here gathered at the annual sunrise ceremony, and as soon as I get word, we'll be going to the speaker. We just heard the voice of Madonna Thunderhawk and Don Gonzalez. That said, I'm waiting to hear from Sara and see if we can take it to the circle.
So my heart is full of love and inspiration that was left for us by the Round Valley Singers and Dancers. They brought us together into one sacred circle. And I only ask that each of us, including myself, remember that feeling, that unity, that dedication to the spirit, to our ways of life, the remembrance of those that went before, that sacrificed what we can't even imagine so that we will still have these ways, these dances, our language, our prayers, the sacred fire, the knowledge of what came before, and the dedication to the lives of our future generations and the children that are here. 526 years ago, and we're here to also commemorate truth in history. This holiday that the United States has, what kind of people dedicate a federal holiday to genocide? I mean, just think about it. You know, where else is that even done? Christopher Columbus was Italian. He was sailing for the Queen of Spain, but he himself was Italian. And after his lost, starving, ragtag band of sailors were welcomed and fed and clothes by our Taino relatives that are still part of the International Ndin Treaty Council. The Tainos are not extinct. The United Confederation of Taino People sit on our board of directors. After they treated him like that, he went back to his boat and he wrote in Italian, "These people are so beautiful and so generous. They live in Dios." That's where the word Indian came from, not from looking for India, which wasn't even a place called that then. They live in Dios, in Italian, in God. And it became the word in Spanish, Indios, and that's why we say Indians now, just to remember that. But then he went on to write in his own diary, "With 50 men, we could enslave them completely." And he went on to enslave them and to slaughter them and to almost wipe them out. So in the memory of the resiliency of our Taino and Arawak brothers and sisters, in the memory of the ancestors of the California Indian people that withstood the gold rush. Again, what does it mean to call the main football team here in San Francisco the 49ers? Think about what that means for a minute. We're all against calling the football team the Redskins, but what does the 49ers mean, really? You know, let's remember the first prisoners on this island were Hopi that refused to give their children up to the policy of kill the Indian, save the child of the forced boarding school assimilations. Let's remember them as we stand here today. Let's remember that the international indigenous movement started here with the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969. Let's honor that. Let's honor that history. Let's teach our children the true history of this place and our movement that continues. And in that way, we're here together to uphold and uplift each other's struggles, to care about one another, to love one another, and to carry that feeling from this circle out into our work and out into the world. Moving forward from this day, each and every one of you here in this circle and all those listening are part of that valiant and noble and heroic history of the indigenous peoples of this land. Chiokwilkesia, thank you.
Oh. Oh. Oh, for Andrea Carmen. Thank you.
Industrial streets, class lines, money talks, turning language to paper pieces, rich man's war, free man society, raging violent insecurity, nuclear man, nuclear woman, unclear how to act, rich man's war, Pershing's cruising Europe, America, Russia, governmental nuclear views. Industrial allies cutting the world as though they cannot see blood flowing. Rich man's war. Central America bleeding, wounds same as Palestine and Harlem. 3 Mile Island in El Salvador, Pine Ridge in Belfast. Rich man's war. The poor starving for food, starving for land, starving for peace, starving for real. Rich man's war, attacking human, attacking being, attacking earth, attacking tomorrow. Rich man's war, thinking of always war, thinking of always war. With machines for ancestors, new unborn generations, chemical umbilical cords are only wiring. In your electrical progress, human lies, burnt offerings to the god greed. With lies for ancestors, there is no truth in some futures. rulers of minds feeding next generation souls to the control machine. Sacrifice ritual for the proper technology. With isolation for ancestors. There's only the present, bought by the credit material users. Forging chains binding you to destruction. The compliments of your deities. The industrial priest. Face who we really are. Some point we have no choice. Distant star, distant light. In real world we are human being. In shadow of real world we are being human. Neon mask for neon flash. Distant thunder, distant cloud. Passion's rain. Drenched in possession, what we take is hard to do. What we do is hard to take. Someone's are crazy, or maybe we take turns. Dreaming about some kind of life, we say it could have been different. But it wasn't, because we weren't. No matter what, it turns out the same. A lot of things we said weren't true. Industrial stories in an electric instant. Neon mask. Neon flash. Neon flash. Thing is, nihilistic desire. Civilized, gone insane. Didn't imagine it turning like this. Some things start good and go bad. Some things get bad and stay bad. Are we caught in between living a lie or not living at all? Eliminated choices, lost in dreams we let go. Memories we never got to have, something else to think about. Waking up in industrial society, surrounded by angry days. Going through motions of not being. Wanting the best but not expecting it. Surviving paid for in dreams. Feeling like a world alone. Serving God with the devil to pay. Feeling like something in no place. What goes on in hell anyway? Thing is, it has to do with heart. We have to understand what hearts are for before we can get back to heaven or paradise. Or the power in our mind.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
U.S. American culture is steeped in myths about its founding and about this land's indigenous inhabitants. Columbus Day is celebrated in many states as a day to mark the fictitious arrival of Italian explorer Christopher Columbus as part of the U.S.'s origin story. Thanksgiving is intended by many Americans to symbolize a fanciful and innocent tale of pilgrims and Indians feasting peacefully to mark the fall harvest. In a new book, authors Dina Gilio Whitaker and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz eviscerate these and other myths. Welcome to the show, Dina.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. I couldn't decide on which of these myths to select to discuss. There's too many of them for us to discuss in the course of this interview. So I picked out some that I think are just really these persistent and pernicious myths. And one of them, which is the one that's been in the news often, is this Washington football team that uses as its name a horrifically derogatory term for Native Americans, but the team owner, Dan Snyder, maintains that it is intended to honor Native Americans. How do you take apart that myth?
It's kind of a tough one, and Native people have been trying to do that for over 20 years, starting with Suzanne Schoen Harjo and her project at the Morning Star Institute. You know, with this particular one, I think the place to start is by understanding that the term Redskins really goes back to the history of when the United States was collecting bounties for Indian heads. That happened well before the foundation of the United States, going back to the colonies, and it extended well into the 19th century in California. I mean, and that's, you know, fairly in the scope of time. That's pretty recent. The United States paid bounties for Indian heads, or, you know, they would say sometimes skins. And the reason that it was skins was because, practically speaking, to hunt a person and decapitate them and carry their head around was way too cumbersome. They were very heavy. And so what they did was they adopted the practice of scalping as a way to collect those bounties to lighten up the load. I know it's crazy to talk about this in such kind of normalized terms, but this was the practical reality of how things were dealt with. So they would carry around these scalps, right? These skins, these red skins, instead of heads. And so for Native people, that's what that invokes for us.
There's indigenous communities in Hawaii, in Alaska, in California, multiple communities in various states. How do we talk about them? I know, like, for example, indigenous Canadians have adopted the term First Nations. In Australia, communities have been referred to and refer to themselves as Aboriginals. In the United States, have we really ever agreed upon a term? And is that even the wrong question to ask?
Well, no, because we devote an entire chapter to that very concept about, you know, what do we call ourselves? What do Native Americans call? And, you know, we talk about that in the book with the chapter titled Indians Can't Agree on What to Be Called. And that's not really true, but I understand that it's really sort of a perception in the non-Native community, and it's been the topic of conversation for, you know, decades. But, you know, we have the terms that really originate out of a sense of political correctness, which really comes out of the post-civil rights era, when Native concerns and issues really start to become more visible in the social landscape of the country. So the term Native Americans emerges in order to distinguish between, you know, Native people, Indians, and non-Indians. Before that, we were just Indians, right? Like, I and Roxanne are both old enough to have grown up in the era where we were just called Indians. And, you know, that's how my ancestors knew themselves after, you know, the coming of the Europeans. So for some people, that has a negative connotation, maybe for younger people. For me personally, I'm used to it. It doesn't bother me. I don't like the term Native American because it highlights the American part of being Native, as though it centralizes the reality of being an American citizen. And personally, that doesn't work for me. And the same with American Indians. Again, it centralizes this concept of being American. But we've been indigenous peoples for far longer, obviously, than we were Americans. Really, it comes down to the most sensible or the most accurate way of describing Native peoples is by associating them with their own national names or nation names. In my case, I'm Colville. But, you know, we have over 500 tribes in the United States that are federally recognized. And that means that the vast majority of them are really unknown to the general American public, who really the average citizen probably can only name maybe a handful or 10 or so Native nations, you know, the most popular ones like Cherokee, Navajo, and, you know, even maybe even Sioux, and maybe a couple of others. But that leaves the vast majority, which are really unrecognized by the average Americans. So if I say I'm Colville, people would look at me and not know what the heck I'm talking about. And to break it down even further, in my case, the Colville Confederated Tribes is a confederation of 12 different bands and nations, and my lineage within that is called Sinaixt. So that's even more confusing. So that's why there's, you know, so much confusion about how do we talk about tribes and nations. And even the word tribe has a whole problematic association that is linked to the concept of inferiority of indigenous peoples.
But all of this argues that what we as Americans, particularly non-indigenous Americans, need to do more than anything else is educate ourselves about these myriad rich communities that exist today that have not been all wiped out, despite what our textbooks might imply. You take on the theory of the Bering Strait migration that some scientists have put forward as an explanation for how these lands became originally populated. Why is that a myth?
It's a myth because it's only a theory. It's one of those things where, you know, if you tell a story over and over and over again enough times, it becomes truth, right? Despite the fact that it really has only ever been a theory. There has never been any substantial evidence, like archaeological evidence, to demonstrate that. It was really only an explanation. And as the years go by, with more archaeological evidence that emerges from places very far away, like South America, for example, it breaks down that theory as being really unviable. For example, as we write about in the book, they're finding evidence, you know, like human remains in South America that they carbon date to 22,000 years. So it troubles the whole Bering Strait theory. And God, there was a story that came out a few weeks ago that further eroded that theory. And so, as we talk about in the book, science is not immune to politics. And that's what this comes down to. You have a century of anthropologists and other kinds of scientists who adhere to these theories in the interest of advancing their own careers, their own academic careers, because it becomes too politically motivated to challenge those theories within the academic institutions. So whenever people do, they lose credibility as professionals.
Right. And then there's the myth that you take on that, quote, Indians are anti-science. Let's talk about this idea of Native American communities, indigenous communities being anti-science. How do you undermine that myth?
Well, first of all, we can even just say the word science itself. The word science has its roots in the Greek. And all that word means is knowledge, like to understand something, you know, how you gain knowledge. And that brings up how you come to know something, how you come to know the world around you. And Native people always had their own ways of understanding the world, and they did that through observation. They developed all kinds of systems of knowledge that were actually far more advanced than they get credit for in the world of science and education. For example, many tribes had systems of astronomy that were extremely advanced. They knew what was going on in the sky. They knew that there were rotations of planets and stars and the sun, and they developed elaborate calendars. So they understood the seasons. They knew what was going on because they'd been observing it for thousands of years. And in some cases, they had developed elaborate systems of irrigation. The Hohokam culture, for example, in North America, they had developed an extremely elaborate irrigation system, which allowed them to have very advanced agricultural practices. And the same was true for the mound builder, what we call the mound builder cultures, which existed before the arrival of Europeans. They had a huge city. Historians estimate that they, at their peak, had probably 50,000 people. It was a very, very complex society based on accumulation of food stores, and they had very large buildings and temples and things like that. That civilization came and went, and by the time the Europeans came, they were gone. But there's just a whole lot of different ways that Native people understood the world, and they understood the world based on their own views of the world, which always had to do with understanding the limitations of nature. And that's what we call sustainability today.
The other, of course, most pernicious myth that was really at the heart of the origin story of this country was that, quote, Indians were savage and warlike. This is the title of one of the myths that you take on in your book, which has helped to, of course, justify genocide, justify expansionism and settler colonialism. I mean, it seems so sad that we have to talk about human beings not being by nature savage and warlike in 2016, but let's do it anyway, because sadly that myth still persists. How do you face this very racist myth that Native Americans, that indigenous communities in this country, back when the country was taken over by white settlers, were all savage and warlike?
How do we face it? I would say that the way that we understand it is by understanding that the way that the dominant settler society, as you said, justified and rationalized how they took over the land was by understanding Native peoples as inferior. And that's really one of the foundational premises of the book, because this concept of Indian inferiority is written into the very fabric of this country. It's codified into law. It's still in practice. And most people don't understand that. The entire body of federal Indian law is premised on it. And that goes back to these ancient, archaic documents of the Catholic Church that are called papal bulls, in which they had this whole story about Native people, by virtue of them not being Christians, they were heathens, they were infidels. And by just that fact alone, they had constructed Native peoples as being savage. And that was even before they'd ever even encountered them. So by the time they get here, they come with weapons, they come, you know, with Christopher Columbus and his slave trade. I mean, that was how Native people were introduced to Europeans, was through this imported slave trade. There was 100 years of slavery in this country before the Mayflower people ever got here. For 100 years, there was a slave trade. And, we don't hear about that. And so that's part of this construction of indigenous peoples being inferior and savage.
Todo empieza con una llamarada cuando despedimos llamas de nuestras miradas. Quieren detener el incendio que se propaga, pero hay fuegos que con agua no se apagan. Y se acerca la línea policíaca, los músculos se tensan y aumenta la frecuencia cardíaca. Suben los niveles de testosterona y empieza ese momento en el que se enfrentan las personas. Cuando somos amigos del coraje, cuando gritar se convierte en nuestro único lenguaje. A mí me ordena la razón, a ti te ordena un coronel. Si nuestra lucha es de cartón, la de ustedes es de papel. Y no nos paran, porque un mensaje contundente convierte a cualquier teniente en un tiburón sin dientes. El Estado nos teme, porque al mismo tiempo somos 132 y 15M si la prensa no habla.
Nosotros damos los detalles,
pintando las paredes
con aerosol en las calles.
Levanto mi pancarta y la difundo, con solo una persona que la lea ya empieza a cambiar el mundo. Cualquier pregunta que tengamos la adormecen. Son las mentiras recalentadas, nos alimentan con carne procesada y la gente sigue desinformada. Una noticia mal contada es un asalto a mano armada. Nos infiltramos, nos duplicamos como las células, nos multiplicamos. Al que no quiere caldo se le dan dos tazas. Somos la levadura que levanta la masa. Nuestras ideas son libres y están despiertas, porque pensamos con las puertas abiertas. Lo que no se ve lo estamos viendo. Nacimos sin saber hablar, pero vamos a morir diciendo.
Una sota me pide. Junta, junta, coro con coro, paso, paso con paso. Cuando cada vez más gente se suma.
We the world your propaganda made. But where you think you are strong, you are weak. Your lies tell us the truth we will use against you. Your secrecy shows us where we will strike. Your weapons reveal your fear for all to see. From Cairo to Quito, a new world is forming. The power of people armed with the truth.
Over the past 4 weeks, it feels like everyone has been talking about Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh every single day. Like, if you took a shot every time the news mentioned Brett Kavanaugh, you would be Brett Kavanaugh. So, for our own mental health, let's take a break from this madness and talk about something else. Donald Trump. I don't know if you guys know this, but Donald Trump is the president of the United States. He probably texted you about it today. And one of the reasons he got that job was that he sold himself as a self-made billionaire who would do for America what he did for himself. And yesterday we found out more about his amazing road to riches.
The president has always portrayed himself as a master businessman, using the art of the deal to turn a small loan into a global empire. But now a New York Times investigation claims he was actually given a fortune from his father's real estate company, often through, quote, dubious tax schemes.
I got a very, very small loan from my father many years ago. I built that into a massive empire, and I paid my father back that loan.
It's a story Donald Trump has been telling for decades.
I started with $1 million loan. I built a company that's worth more than $10 billion.
But reporters for the New York Times, who say they examined more than 100,000 pages of documents, claim it isn't true. They report Donald Trump's father, Fred, actually lent him at least $60.7 million.
Wait, what? Okay, I don't know about you, but I'm devastated right now. Because the one thing I knew about Donald Trump is that he was a self-made billionaire. And now you're saying that's not real? Like, what's next? You're gonna tell me that's not his real hair? Huh? That his natural complexion isn't sunset? Huh? Well, because this exposes Trump's whole origin story as a lie. And I mean, like, a total lie. This is like finding out that Superman was actually born in Cleveland and he can't even fly. It's just an elaborate system of pulleys, okay? Which is still impressive, but not the same. And now look, let's be honest. I don't think any of us really ever believed that Trump was self-made. We knew that his dad gave him a leg up in life. But the New York Times has shown that Fred didn't just give Donald a leg up. He was basically all of his limbs.
Fred Trump was relentless and creative in finding ways to channel his wealth to his children. He made Donald not just his salaried employee, but also his property manager, landlord, banker, and consultant. He gave him loan after loan, many of them never repaid. He gave him 3 trust funds. He gave him shares in multiple partnerships. And he gave him laundry revenue from his buildings. He provided money for Donald's car, money for his employees, money to buy stocks, money for his first Manhattan offices, and money to renovate those offices.
Okay, this is just embarrassing. Right? It's one thing to be a trust fund baby, it's another thing to be a baby, right? You're a 40-year-old man and your daddy is still paying for your office furniture? Like, did you do anything for yourself, Donald? Huh? Did you actually bang those models in the 80s, or was that your dad too, huh? Were you in that room like, are you gonna give it to me, Donald? It's like, no, but my daddy will. So,
Fred Trump was funneling enormous amounts of money to Donald for decades. And it all started before young Donnie even knew what money was.
According to the investigation, Trump was earning $200,000 in today's dollars by age 3 and was a millionaire by the age of 8. By the time Donald was 17, his father had given him part ownership of a 52-unit apartment building.
Wow, $200,000 as a toddler and a millionaire by the age of 8. That is not normal. That's not a normal way to grow up. Like, it turns everything upside down. I bet Donald Trump never even got bullied, because if they ever took his lunch money, the bullies would instantly be in a higher tax bracket, you know? Just be like, I really want to give him a wedgie, but my accountant says it's not worth it. If we were in the Cayman Islands, boy, you'd be getting it right now. Now, usually, when your parents gift you hundreds of millions of dollars, you would need to pay taxes on that, right? A lot of taxes. But these are the Trumps we're talking about, and that's not how they roll.
The New York Times report that indicates President Trump helped his father cheat the federal government and avoid for years on end paying millions and millions of dollars in federal taxes. Fred Trump used a sham company to funnel tax-free money to his children. The Trumps manipulated the value of their apartment buildings, claiming they were worth millions of dollars less than fair value.
He helped transfer more than $1 billion of his parents' wealth to himself and his siblings. A sum, they report, would have produced a tax bill of at least $550 million. But they say the family employed a variety of tax dodges, cutting that to $52.2 million.
Sweet Jesus. So according to the Times, Donald Trump, the president, by the way, remember, stole $500 million from the American government. Yeah. It's like if you robbed a bank and then they were like, you know what, we're going to make you the CEO. Yeah. And you know, the one part of the story that brings me joy is that in order to pay less tax, Trump had to pretend his properties were worth less than they actually were. That must have been such torture for him. Be like, so you see, I shouldn't pay that much. The properties are actually not that great. They're the greatest! No, they're not. They're not. Don't listen to me. Listen to me! So what this report tells us is that Donald and his dad worked together to defraud the U.S. government for decades. We also learned that Donald needed his father to repeatedly bail out his failing businesses. But as it turned out, Donald was so bad at business that some of his dad's fortune wasn't enough. He needed all of it.
At that crucial point in his life, 1990, we found Donald Trump crafts, in essence, a new will for his father. And then he sends lawyers to his father's house to have him sign it.
His father had no idea this was coming and flipped out.
His father looked at this and thought, this is my son who is in incredible trouble right now, trying to get control of the empire that I built.
Okay, I've heard of the apple not falling far from the tree. I've never heard of the apple falling off the tree and then trying to take all of the tree's money. I'm just saying that piece of fruit is an asshole. And you're probably wondering, what happens now? Well, I have bad news for you. Because of the statutes of limitations, the worst that could happen to Trump is that he pays a fine. But he will definitely not go to prison. Which we should know by now. Trump doesn't go to prison. That's just not how the story goes. Like, there's a bigger chance we'll all go to prison for Trump's taxes. Yeah, we'll just be in the cell like, I'm not gonna lie, I did not see this coming. I did not see this coming. And the worst part is, the Trump who blew through a fortune and stuck his dad with the bill, that Trump never went away. Yeah. You realize that since Trump took office less than 2 years ago, the projected national debt has skyrocketed by $1.6 trillion. So I guess what I'm saying is, we're all Fred Trump now.
I want a president who believes in evolution. I want a president who believes in democracy. I want a president who supports the Constitution. I want a president who speaks the English language fluently. I want a president who believes in science, who supports stem cell research and ecology. I want a president who wants to help reduce global warming and help us stop using oil as our main source of energy. I want a president who's really patriotic, who would never send our children off to die needlessly. But right now I'd settle for a president who's not psychotic and living in a faith-based reality. I want a president that is an intellectual, who is curious about the world and reads the paper every day, who cares more about human rights than corporations, and will defend your rights, be you woman, black or brown or gay. I want a president to help reduce nuclear weapons. I want a president who doesn't want to start a war. I want a president to respect the Geneva Convention. I want a president who won't condone torture anymore. I want a president who believes in evolution. I want a president who believes in democracy. I want a president to support the Constitution. I want a president who's more intelligent than me.
We end today's show with a remarkable new book titled How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, which focuses in particular on current trends under the Trump administration, arguing that the president is not as much of an anomaly in American history as we often think. The book's author, Yale professor Jason Stanley, whose parents were both Holocaust survivors who came to the U.S. as refugees, shows instead that, quote, in its own history, the United States can find a legacy of the best of liberal democracy, as well as the roots of fascist thought. Indeed, Hitler was inspired by the Confederacy and Jim Crow laws, Jason Stanley writes. He also warns of the dangers of normalizing fascist politics, saying, quote, what normalization does is transform the morally extraordinary into the ordinary. It makes us able to tolerate what was once intolerable by making it seem as if this is the way things have always been.
We're joined right now by Jason Stanley. Welcome to Democracy Now! Professor, it's great to have you with us. Why now? Why are you releasing this book, How Fascism Works Now?
Well, we have a global ultranationalist far-right movement crossing many countries, Bolsonaro in Brazil, we've just seen, and they feed off each other. So I think right now it's very important to make people aware of the features of fascism, the historical features, and to alert people to the fact that the United States has always been vulnerable to this kind of politics.
Well, explain what fascism, define what it means for you.
So fascism is an ideology based on power. Liberal democracy is based on liberty and equality. Liberty and equality require truth because you need truth to speak truth to power. And if you're lied to, you're not free. No one thinks the people of North Korea are free. They've been lied to. So if you're going to attack liberal democracy and replace it with power, you need to smash truth. So fascism is an ideology based on power and loyalty. It's based on hypernationalism, so one group, loyalty to one group, and one person, the leader, represents that group. It's hypermasculine and hyperpatriarchal.
You talk about the 10 pillars of fascism. What are they?
The 10 pillars of fascism are, number one, a mythic past, a great mythic past to which the leader hearkens back. Number two, propaganda, where everything is inverted. The news is the fake news. Anti-corruption is corruption. So three, anti-intellectualism. As Steve Bannon said, emotion, rage gets people to the polls. We got elected on lock her up and build the wall. Hitler in Mein Kampf says, you want your propaganda to appeal to the least educated people. Number four, unreality. You have to smash truth. So reason gets replaced by conspiracy theories. I first started writing, got out of my academic shell in 2011 when I wrote a piece about birtherism because I saw conspiracy theories coming, and that's a deeply concerning sign. Unreality. So you smash truth, so all that remains is loyalty. Hierarchy. In fascist politics, the dominant group is better than everyone else. They were like the great people in the past who deserve respect just for being them. Victimhood. In fascism, the dominant group are the greatest victims. The men are the greatest victims of encroaching feminism. Whites are the greatest victims of blacks. Germans are the greatest victims of Jews. Law and order. What are they victims of? They're victims of the outgroup who are criminals. What kind of criminals are there? They're rapists, sexual anxiety. Pillar nine is Sodom and Gomorrah. The real values come from the heartland. The people in the city are decadent. And pillar 10 is Arbeit macht frei. Work shall make you free. The outgroup is lazy. They're not just criminals. They're lazy. And social Darwinism, it's all about winning.
Well, I want to turn to one of the features of fascism as you identify it, this unreality. Trump was speaking earlier this year, and he took aim at the media, as indeed he has multiple times, using a phrase that prompted comparisons with George Orwell's dystopian novel, 1984.
Just remember, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening. So we have to make our country truly great again. Remember? Make America great again. And then in 2.5 years, it's called Keep America Great.
So that's Trump speaking earlier this year. And just to say that George Orwell's line reads, the party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command. So can you talk about this particular feature of fascism as you see it in the U.S. under Trump?
Yeah, you have Trump is very clear that loyalty to him is the only guide. Reality is, of course, the greatest threat to fascism because fascism is based on power and reality. Reality is a way of responding to power. You say it's just false. So you have to make everyone destabilized, not connected to the truth, and you have to represent yourself as reality. And you have to show that you're stronger than reality because fascism is about machismo and power.
You are the son of Holocaust survivors. How does that weigh in to your scholarly work and what you're seeing now? And whether you believe you can talk about the United States in this way right now?
Well, I remember when I talked to my father about being the son of a Holocaust survivor, and he read me James Baldwin's 1968 piece, Negroes Are Anti-Semitic Because They're Anti-White. And one of the lines in it was, you think you're more connected to us because of our shared history of oppression? We're more angry at you because of our shared history of oppression, because we know you're glad not to be us. So because of my background, my mother worked in Manhattan Criminal Court for 33 years. I knew that the United States was replicating features of Nazi Germany and Eastern Europe with respect to its black population. So I was raised with an understanding of racialized mass incarceration. I lived through it. We're still living through it. 9% of the world's prison population is black American. If the nation of black America was its own country, it should be the third largest nation on earth. And that's an emergency. So we came in, we've long had this fake news directed against our black population. And it's completely unsurprising that someone came and then said, hey, you're used to fake news being directed against this population. Let's just generalize it and direct it against everyone.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Because we believe that
there is some kind of
conspiracy.
A secret organization working against the party.
And that you are involved in it.
Do you want to join it? Will you work for it?
We are enemies of the party.
We disbelieve.
We're thought criminals.
Are you willing to commit murder?
Yes.
Acts of sabotage?
Yes.
To betray your country to foreign powers?
Yes.
To cheat, to blackmail, to corrupt the minds of children? Anything that weakens the party?
Yes.
To use only 140 characters?
Yes.
To commit suicide?
Yes.
To separate and never see one another again?
No.
No. O'Brien sets down his glass.
When you receive orders, they come from me. When you are caught, you will confess. You won't betray me because I'll be dead or I'll have a different face. We will be fighting in the dark.
Are we always fighting in the dark? Is the Brotherhood...
You will never learn more about the Brotherhood. It exists and you belong to it.
Winston feels a wave of worshipful admiration towards O'Brien. Even Julia is impressed.
You have heard rumors of the Brotherhood.
Meetings in cellars. Secret conspirators.
Messages on walls.
Code words.
No.
O'Brien explains that the Brotherhood cannot be wiped out because it is not an organization in the ordinary sense. Nothing holds it together except an idea. O'Brien looks at his watch.
To the death of the Thought Police?
To the death of Big Brother. Winston and Julia take their leave. O'Brien puts his hand on the telescreen, working, as always, for the party.
Say anything I know, and I don't know anything I can say.
Would you like some tea?
Oh, thank you. You know that it was all staged.
I thought Patty Hearst was great in Serial Mom.
Wait, he's trying to tell us something.
The Symbian Knees Liberation Army is as real as ISIS.
I'm too young to get beheaded.
Stick to the script, and nobody gets hurt.
Why is everybody so tense all the time?
The strategy of tension is designed to maximize stress, to pump up the fear.
But why?
To protect you.
From what?
To protect you from the weather underground. From Patty Hearst and the Symbionese Army. From Jim Jones and the Underpants Bomber. From the anthrax letters. From rice cooker bombs. And Marilyn Manson. Scripted. Made for TV news. Targeting your thoughts with paralyzing doubt so that you will demand troop carriers and SWAT teams for local police. The Pentagon Office of Deception Management collaborates with the New York Times every day, CNN, and Disney. They don't produce headlines. They produce instructions. Page one. Airport body scanners annoying, but passengers compliant. That's not only a headline, it's also your instructions. It's okay to complain, but you must be compliant. We have you in our gun sights. I can wipe you out with impunity, like a zombie bank. I know you put truth serum in my tea, but it doesn't matter. It's
no longer secret. Edward Snowden leaked it. What good is a surveillance state if nobody knows about it?
Round four. The category is disinformation. For 300 points, give a misleading answer to this question. Which socialism?
Social what?
Repeat the question.
Which socialism?
Techno-scientific socialism.
Bank bailouts?
Bank bailouts. We have a winner.
Yay! That's two for me.
Are you okay with that?
I have nothing to hide.
So, you are a good slave.
I try to be good at what I do. I mean...
Is that a kind of thought control?
I like to mindlessly lose control of my mind and body sometimes. I mean, if we can agree on a safe word.
Like stop?
Oh, stop or I'll shoot.
You think you are safer when only the government is armed?
It's my right.
The right to be defenseless in a police state.
And the right to drink fluoridated water.
I try to drink a variety of heavy metals every day.
Most countries have stopped fluoridating their drinking water.
What's your point?
My point? Oh, God, do I have a point now?
Forcing me to drink fluoridated water is slavery.
Well, I eat chemical-laden processed food, too.
Admit it. You depend on Big Pharma for your mental health.
What mental health?
Your emotional state is a classifiable disease.
I am feeling a little fragile.
Your mind has been droned by the Associated Press.
I'm feeling so helpless. What can I do?
I prescribe a limited media fast. No more corporate news feeding.
I promise. No more corporate news for a week.
Get a hold of yourself.
Dump the Associated Press.
Dump Reuters. It's illegal for profit-driven wire services to report the truth.
Except emergencies.
Especially in emergencies.
Is there any discussion?
Do you want the terrorists to win?
The Joint Chiefs?
The Associated Press.
The Associated Press is in bed with the Joint Chiefs.
Why do you have to be so snarky all the time?
They want to kill you.
What did I do?
You are too obedient. Disobedience promotes healthy complexion and saves lives.
I'm willing to try. Can I break my media fast?
We have a tie.
I don't get it.
It's time to renew your KPFA membership.
Am I a member now?
Do you listen to the station? And have you donated $25?
Well, I listen, but I never donate.
I am not a philanthropist. I tip the kid who mows my lawn. That's it.
Not true. You never tip. He pays me $3 an hour.
So sue me. I haven't donated to KPFA in 20 years, and I always get away with it. Why should I stop now?
So please, donate something nice. The choice is yours. Alone.
This is our new song, Her, by Gracie and Rachel. I'm Gracie on Pacifica KPFA.
Call out
Be allowed to elect the local station board.
Allowed? This is our station, lady. We own it. We vote to approve the budget.
I always tell my students that elections are boring.
You are a very bad teacher.
I know. I was voted the world's worst teacher by my students 5 years in a row.
Why are you so proud of that?
Well, my students are very smart.
Don't you get it? Your students are ridiculing you.
Oh, do you think so?
Are you Common Core compliant?
Oh, yes, of course. I'm in bed with Bill and Melinda Gates. Definitely.
That's disgusting.
It is called satire, dear.
Well, I find that very hard to believe.
We are talking with the world's worst charter school teacher.
Would somebody please define satire?
Fact check.
Satire is code for you can't say that.
For 50 points, give an offensive answer to this question. What are the 7 words that must never be spoken on the radio?
I should know this.
Wait, repeat the question.
The 7 words that must never be spoken on mainstream radio. What are they?
Nanothermite. False flag terrorism. Building 7.
We have a winner.
Why is it forbidden to say Building 7 on mainstream media?
The government would fall. It would end the wars.
You know, my students say that too. But what do they know? They get all their information from the internet.
And where do you get your information?
CNN and Instagram. Look, a cat smoking a cigar.
This is Twit Radio, half true, more or less 100% of the time.
Now, new film, Zero Dark 30, examines the 10-year hunt for bin Laden. You started with looking at a man in custody being tortured. What's the point? And tell me why.
Movies can change attitudes about torture, Charlie.
As a psychological weapon, this is the mission.
If you did not know what waterboarding is, you do now.
what's interesting about the fact that a former art student in San Francisco is now directing movies like this? What is it about you that likes looking at a man in custody being tortured?
I don't really like torture. I hate it. I refused to shoot that scene. Torture is unreliable. Torture is rape. Osama didn't mastermind anything. He was dying of kidney failure in 2001, for God's sake.
You have said about this movie, you wanted to show torture. Why?
I can answer that. Normalizing torture is a gradual process.
A transition period like this requires patience.
Eventually, torture will no longer be thought of as un-American.
I can be tortured too. We all can.
Miss Bigelow, you may be annoyed. You must be compliant.
Zero Dark 30 is the title. So you made a decision in making this movie to show a human face of a variety of torture and extraordinary movie. What have you learned that you didn't really know?
The Defense Intelligence Agency has a budget 800 times larger than the CIA.
The Pentagon Film Office is not just approving scripts involving the military.
Even the Daily Show has a minder on their writing staff.
Ridicule can give aid and comfort to the enemy.
I mean, the thing that also amazes me, you know why he got away from Tora Bora?
Well, was he ever really in Tora Bora?
After 9/11, I mean, there were all kinds of things going on with American national security people doing everything they could to get somebody tortured, to give them some information as to where Osama bin Laden was. Tell me how you two work together. You're a director, he's a writer, but this is a tortured team.
We only know what they tell us.
The creative team doesn't need to know the entire backstory.
As the film's director, I would really like to know the facts.
Accuracy in a pseudo-documentary is a fantasy.
From the audience point of view, Osama has to have escaped from Tora Bora.
He was last seen hooked up to a dialysis machine in Pakistan in 2001, for heaven's sake.
Catherine, an award-winning torture flick has to have a spectacular villain. Escaping from Tora Bora makes Osama unworthy of
there was some exasperation within the United States government about the torture failure to find Osama bin Laden. And if you ask anybody, as I did often at this table, they would say, we don't know. And they would say, we've lost the trail.
Charlie, Mr. Rose, you know damn well that is not believable that the trail would have been lost for 10 years. Did Osama hide his dialysis machine under a burqa?
That isn't believable.
The dialysis machine was cut from the story years ago.
Without an evil mastermind, audiences will not root for torturers.
If I had stayed in art school, I could have been a great artist.
What was the most difficult thing for you as a filmmaker to take this brilliant screenplay and turn it into a torture story?
The voice is Charlie Rose. I'm Brooklyn Kidd, and this is Tripit Radio. I want to know why that interview was never broadcast until now. Why?
Because you hacked into Charlie Rose's computer and ripped it off, probably.
I don't know what to believe.
Acute belief disorder is a strategic weapon.
Wait, acute what?
Acute belief disorder.
It's like critical thinking, but without the thinking.
On the astral plane, there are many listeners like me. Myself made a donation from the grave. I put it in my will before I passed over to the spirit world. And now I listen to KPFA on the cloud.
Are you a crackpot?
He's a crackpot.
I'm a kook. There's a difference.
Do you think the moon landings were faked?
No. The moon landings were real.
How can you be so sure?
Well, the astronauts drove four-wheel drive dune buggies on the moon, and I saw it on YouTube with my own eyes.
Yeah, that was cool.
But what if the video you saw was faked?
That's impossible because Photoshop didn't exist in 1969.
Is that your evidence? Neil Armstrong walked on the moon because Photoshop hadn't been invented yet?
I didn't say he walked on the moon. I said he had wheels. I saw the video. The astronauts were popping wheelies, and that couldn't be faked in 1969.
Why are we talking about this?
For 1,000 points, give a half-true answer to this question. How did the astronauts get a four-wheel drive moon buggy on the moon?
Inflatable aluminum.
Wrong.
Hypnotic suggestion.
Wronger.
Stanley Kubrick.
We have a tie. Nobody wins.
Yay. 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 Popularly known as the Moon Buggy, 3 463-pound battery-powered off-road vehicles were transported to the moon in 1971 and 1972 to collect moon rocks for Michiko Kaku.
Well, let's take the next listener phone call. Hello, this is Science Fantastic. You're on the air. Any comments or questions?
I'm one of those people, actually, I might be one of those kooks that doesn't think we went to the moon. I don't think I'm a kook. I think I've got good reason to think we didn't go to the moon.
Some people think that we never brought moon rock back from the moon. Well, I had a chance to actually look at moon rock close up with a microscope, and I was shocked.
When President Ronald Reagan met Mikhail Gorbachev, he said that if we were ever attacked by the Martians, you and me, the Soviets and the capitalist U.S., would be allies in the fight against the Martians. Well, that's how Ronald Reagan looked at it, and believe it or not, there's some truth to it. If we are faced with a common enemy in outer space, it would indeed help to unite the Earth, just the way Ronald Reagan said.
In our obsession with antagonisms of the moment, we often forget how much unites all the members of humanity. Perhaps we need some outside universal threat to make us recognize this common bond. I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us? What could be more alien to the universal aspirations of our peoples than war and the threat of war? What if all of us in the world discovered that we were threatened by an outer power from outer space, from another planet? Wouldn't we all of a sudden find that we didn't have any differences between us at all? We were all human beings, citizens of the world, and wouldn't we come together to fight that particular threat?
Reagan and Michiko Kaku. I'm Berkeley Kid, and this is TwitWit Radio. Half true, more or less 100% of the time.
Yeah, the moon buggy was 10 feet long. It had two seats and Velcro fastened safety belts.
You're making that up.
And how many moon buggies were left on the moon?
Three lunar roving vehicles were left on the moon. I don't believe it. I want to see for myself. Show me the pictures.
There are pictures?
Yeah, Hubble Space Telescope could easily photograph the lunar landing sites right now, but NASA won't do it.
I'm sick and tired of being humiliated and lied to by Makicho Kaku and Don Ronald Reagan, who want to scare me all the time.
Don't you get it?
An alien space invasion is needed to unite all nations under a central world bank to bring peace.
The banks don't want peace. They want global control.
When I'm elected to the local station board, I will pass a resolution to have the Hubble Space Telescope take some pictures of the moon.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Once I had my heroes, once I had my dreams, but all of that is
Trump just tweeted.
Tweeted? I thought we blocked him on Twitter.
You're right, I thought we did block him. This isn't a tweet. This is a text message.
That's impossible. He can't text us, can he?
Now he's texting fake news Stormy Daniels.
Don't look at it!
What?
Mommy, what's a witch hunt?
What?
Give me that. Now he's texting the kid's iPad.
Fake news! Fake news!
No!
Look it up!
No! Get rid of it!
You have 21 new messages from Donald Trump.
No!
Get out of here!
Help.
We're not safe in here!
Camera set. Perfect.
Everything's recorded. Nobody can betray me. And there's absolutely nothing that can go wrong, that's for sure. Because it's all on tape, right? That's right, Donald. Hey, buddy. When you watch this tape, remember that you set these cameras up and don't get scared.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Warren, and I need two pizzas, and I want it sent to my home address, which is 222 Cherokee Drive, Pocahontas, Massachusetts. Anonymous. I don't see what the big deal is. Kids love being separated from their families. It's like camp. Anonymous.
Come on, Mike.
I'm trying, sir. You can only do one at a time.
Why did we write all this stuff down in the first
place? I don't remember.
Anonymous.
Oh, sir, I was writing your memoirs because you didn't want to do it.
Right? That's great. I love memoirs. Sure. They're the things in your head that you cry about.
And then put on paper.
Make sure you include that I killed Osama bin Laden, and that I passed the health care bill,
yes,
and that I was the first black president.
Coming right up, sir.
Mom, a terrible thing just happened. They're firing me from my job, Mom. I don't know what to do. Mom, what do I do? What do I do, Mom? Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. Can you feel it?
She wanted to get some furniture. I said, I'll show you where they have some nice furniture. I took out furniture. I moved in her like a but I couldn't get there. And she was married. And all of a sudden, I see her. She's now got the big phony and everything. She's totally changed her look.
She's your girl's hot as in the purple.
Whoa. Whoa.
Yes.
Whoa. Oh,
yes, the Donald is good.
Whoa.
Oh, my man.
Yeah, that's her, with the gold. I got to use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the.
Talk about the fact that 2 years ago today the Access Hollywood tape came out.
Oh boy, it's the day that the whole country found out what a dirty little boy I am, looked itself in the mirror, shrugged and said, I guess as a society we really don't value women.
Believe Dr. Ford?
I do not.
Kavanaugh is a victim.
If I was had to vote on it, I would vote that he's telling the truth. Right, but I'm not going to call her a liar.
You're not going to call her a liar?
No.
He's going to insinuate it.
Every bet you take is someone's death in another place. Every healthy smile is hunger and strike to another child. But the stars do shine. Some salvation is near this time. Near this time. Can't feel it now.
The only thing she can remember is that Kavanaugh
punched her button.
Punched her button? Is that a southern term?
We won't get into that.
It's just gotten to the point now. You've got to keep your hands to yourself.
Is that a bad thing or is that a good thing?
Well, you can't even pat people on the back. I mean,
you can't drunkenly run into a dorm room and whip out your thing and put it in somebody's face anymore.
Absolutely not.
What is this world coming to? A better place? It feels like it.
Maybe a better place, but it's really bad getting to that better place.
At what cost, right? If we sacrifice all of these bad habits just to get to a better place, then that just leaves us, you know, with a better, more respectful America.
Absolutely.
And nobody wants that, especially not Donald Trump.
No, he does not. So brothers and sisters, shall we know how?
When you were 18 or so, did you pull a few tricks? Don't lie now.
Well, what are you? Are you talking about like sexual assault?
A few tricks.
I'm gonna say no.
Don't put words in my mouth like the Democrats do.
But I wouldn't put words, or even I wouldn't put thoughts in your head either.
I don't want to put you on the spot.
Women are very inappropriate with their dress. What do you expect to happen?
The women are basically asking for it.
Absolutely.
A short dress, they're gonna whip it out.
Absolutely.
So women kind of bear the brunt of all responsibility.
They do in this.
Yeah.
But you know what?
Now you are a woman, though.
I am a woman.
It feels like that's kind of going against.
I know my boundaries. I know what I'm supposed to do. I'm a Christian, and
of course,
you know.
Sexual abuse allegations were the kind of thing that disqualified you from being in Donald Trump's world. Like, that would rule out Kavanaugh, Porter, Lewandowski, Bannon, Roger Ailes.
You can't take sides. You do not take sides.
No. But you're on, are you Kavanaugh or Ford?
I am Kavanaugh.
Pick that side. Bill Shine, Andrew Puster, Bill O'Reilly.
Well, I think everybody's got things in their closet. Grab them by the... All the children of the West. Grab them by the... Grab him by the...
Got a huge response after announcing yesterday she's voting for Democrat Phil Bredesen over Republican Marsha Blackburn in the U.S. Senate race in Tennessee.
The pop star has always made it a point of keeping silent on politics, but shocked her fans last night. Swift wrote, "I always have and always will cast my vote based on which candidate will protect and fight for the human rights I believe we all deserve in this country." You say I did something bad.
And what did she say?
She said she wants people to vote for Democrats.
Let's say that I like Taylor's music about 25% less now, okay? Oh, you say I did something bad. It wasn't feel
That's a weird way to express displeasure. He likes her music 25% less? Like, what does that even mean? Is he now just going to cut off 25% of his Taylor merchandise? Is that what he's going to do? Oh, and by the way, I love how Trump turned back when he heard Taylor Swift. You see that? Like, because he was leaving. He was leaving, right? And then he heard Taylor Swift and he's like, what? Yeah, because normally reporters shout questions. He just keeps going. They're like, Mr. President, the United Nations global warming. Mr. President, your policy on Hezbollah. Mr. President, what do you think about Taylor Swift? He's like, what's that? What's that? Taylor Swift. Let me tell you something. I know all about this issue from my briefings that I read in United States Weekly.
Kanye is headed to the White House as yet another star Team Trumper is on her way out of the White House. Nikki Haley, Trump's ambassador to the United Nations, surprised everyone today by resigning. She plans to leave the White House by the end of the year. She said she wants to spend more time away from Trump's family. And so she had the president was very keen to spin this particular resignation as a mutually agreeable move. So he and Haley announced it together today. And Trump seemed very sad to see her go.
So, Nikki, I just wanted to tell you that we will miss you. We'll be speaking all the time, but we will miss you nevertheless. And you have done a fantastic job, and I want to thank you very much.
Thank you. Mostly thank you in advance for not writing a book about me. The book, by the way, is called Haley's Vomit, My Time is Trump. It's expected to, just as soon as she leaves, it's going to come out. Truth be told, according to CNN, Haley told her staff this morning she's leaving because she's done 2 years and it's time to move on. Trump already has a terrific candidate in mind to replace Nikki Haley.
I've heard a lot of names. I've heard Ivanka. I've heard how good would Ivanka be? The people that know, there's nothing to do with nepotism, but I want to tell you, the people that know that Ivanka would be dynamite. But, you know, I'd then be accused of nepotism, if you can believe it, right? Yes. I think Ivanka would be incredible. That doesn't mean I'd pick her because you'd be accused of nepotism. Even though I'm not sure there's anybody more competent in the world, but that's okay.
Yes, and what are the odds that the most competent person in the world just happens to be my daughter? Meanwhile, poor Donald Jr. is in a tree stand somewhere in North Dakota watching that on his phone and crying, just a single tear. The president today continued to lash out at protesters who went to Washington over the weekend to speak out against Brett Kavanaugh. You know, our president believes in a lot of nutty conspiracies. Climate change is a hoax started by the Chinese, the millions of illegal voters thing, the witch hunt, Obama being born in Kenya. But this one is special because now he's got a conspiracy theory about his conspiracy theory. This morning, he tweeted, the paid D.C. protesters are now ready to really protest because they haven't gotten their checks. In other words, they weren't paid. Screamers in Congress and outside were far too obvious, less professional than anticipated by those paying or not paying the bills. And he doubled down on that.
You know, a lot of those were paid protesters. You saw that. They're all unhappy because they haven't been paid yet. I've been calling it.
You see, they were paid, but they haven't been paid. So many wackos have convinced each other that all these people out there protesting were actors paid by some shadowy financier. George Soros is a big one they mentioned, because when you go with George Soros, you get just that little hint of anti-Semitism that gives a conspiracy some zest. But, of course, no one was paid to protest. There's zero evidence of that. So Trump, quite brilliantly, I must say, made that into the conspiracy. The paid protesters haven't even been paid. And the thing is, it all comes back around because you know who actually did hire a bunch of people to show up, pretend to be supporters at his campaign announcement, and then didn't pay them for months afterwards? Donald J. Trump. That's right. He is rubber, and we are screwed. This is not a hoax, no matter what he says. There's a new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that says we have 12 years to get our acts together, or we will face catastrophic events, including flooding, droughts, wildfires, disease, and mass death. Basically, we are in the first act of a Michael Bay movie right now, and there's no... Bruce Willis is nowhere to be found. And the craziest part of it is the Trump administration issued their own report that agrees that climate change is going to be a catastrophe, but concludes, and this is not an exaggeration, that we're doomed anyway, so why bother doing anything about it? That is the official policy of the White House.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world serves its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Beat it up, an ox beat. Grunt, no strength.
Liked beer.
Cavalier, renegade, steer clear, a tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Lester Banks, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom, mute, symbiotic, patriotic, slam, button, nap, right?
Take a walk with me.
Come take a walk with me.
let's pretend we're just two people and you're not better than me. I'd like to ask you some questions if we can speak honestly. What do you feel when you see all the homeless on the street? Who do you pray for at night before you go to sleep? What do you feel when you look in the mirror? Are you proud? How do you sleep while the rest of us cry? How do you dream when a mother has no chance to say goodbye? President, were you a lonely boy?
Were you a lonely boy?
Were you a lonely boy?
How can you say no child is left behind? We're not dumb and we're not blind. They're all sitting in your cells while you pave a road to hell. What kind of father would take his own daughter's rights away? And what kind of father might hate his own daughter if she were gay? I can only imagine what the first lady has to say. You've come a long way. President, you'd never take a walk with me. Would you?
This is the Berkeley Signal.